Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
Well, if you're from Kentucky, you've heard of the Cornbread Mafia. And now that the story has come out and shown that it was literally the largest homegrown marijuana syndicate in American history some years ago, and there's a book out about it. There's actually several, but if, in my opinion, I think it's the first, and I believe it's probably the most comprehensive. James Higdon joining us now. He's the author of The Cornbread Mafia, A Homegrown Syndicate's Code of Silence and the Biggest Marijuana Bust in American History. James, how are you?
Leland, I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
James or Jim? How should we go with that?
We've met, so I'm Jim.
Okay.
It's James on the book jacket, and when I was a journalist, that was my byline. It was always nice to have a little buffer. I grew up, my father's Jimmy Higdon, who's a state senator now, but I grew up, he owned a grocery store in Lebanon, so he already knew everybody. So my whole life, I've always bumped into people who knew me and I didn't know them.
Yeah.
And it's always been a source of anxiety for me. and then with the book, there's a whole new level of people who know me. And it's always good to be able to tell how someone knows me right away.
Right.
So the James Higdon is just a nice way to...
You know me from the book. Yeah. Yeah, I got
To know how someone knows me. But we've met, so I'm Jim.
Well, I know your dad well. He's a super guy, great state senator. And it's funny because my wife is from the Lebanon area. So she knew your dad long ago and knew that grocery store. You know, it's a small town, Kentucky, which is kind of what makes you, the story in your book so interesting, is that it was sort of headquartered out of that very area. And, you know, I'm from small town Kentucky. My grandparents are from Wadi. I grew up in Wilmore, Danville, Perryville, Lebanon. These towns, like you said, everyone knows everyone, which makes it all the more fascinating that such an enterprise was happening right under everyone's noses, so to speak.
Well, I think it was a pretty open secret.
Right.
Lebanon and Marion County has, especially for the, you know, for a number of decades, had this special place where the rules of the world didn't really apply there. Mm-hmm. There was this bubble of self-made customs and culture that survived much longer than it would have any other place for, you know, whatever reason. And that was like a permissive attitude about alcohol use, and that kind of rolled into a permissive understanding of contraband marijuana in the 70s and 80s.
Is it, forgive me for asking, was Marion County at the time, was it a dry county despite that permissive attitude towards?
So it was a wet county. So Marion County is a Catholic county.
Okay, gotcha.
So the wet dry falls into a Catholic versus Protestant dialogue.
Right.
And up until very recently, Marion County was the last wet county to the Tennessee line.
Okay.
Just in this last 10 years where counties started to moisten up. You know, Danville has bars and liquor stores now, but when I went to Center, that was not the case.
Right. Yeah, it seems like there was, you know, it would be like those county line liquor stores, you know, like you come right across from Boyle County into Marion County or whatever. And it's interesting that you say it was the closest wet county to the Tennessee line. Did that sort of maybe create the right sort of setting for something like this to evolve in Marion County? Because you know, you would have people coming for alcohol anyway, and maybe
the thread I traced through from the book is that before alcohol prohibition takes effect in 1919, there are 9 active distilleries in Marion County. And one day in 1919, all these distilleries are forced to close.
Right.
And they employed hundreds of men, all of them Catholic, all of them with literally a dozen children each. And they were left with the decision to make. Do they let their families go hungry, or do they break the law? Because the only skill set they had had suddenly been criminalized.
Right.
So this culture in that region of understanding that one could violate man's law without violating God's law sort of took root, and these families figured out how to maintain this position where they were still members of the community and their parishes and the church, but also committing crimes.
I want to trace back through all of this with you a little bit, but there's another really interesting book out about sort of the same time frame, and it's called The Bluegrass Conspiracy. I'm sure you've heard of
it.
Were there connections between the Cornbread Mafia and some of the shenanigans that were going on in Lexington at the time and centered here? Because that was also drug-based, but it was a lot of it was harder drugs than marijuana. But was there any kind of connection there? Did these two groups bump up against each other? Were they connected?
It's a very good question. And in these two books, my book and Bluegrass Conspiracy, are often seen interchangeably. I cover some of the same ground for this reason, because of the overlap. I, in Cornbread, do some new reporting on these guys that Sally Denton reports and writes about in Bluegrass Conspiracy, namely Harold Brown and Drew Thornton. Harold Brown was the corrupt DEA agent in Louisville who was part of that scheme, and Drew Thornton was his buddy. In Louisville, a police officer, dirty cop, what have you. The connections, so yes, but not directly.
Right.
So you're right. The Bluegrass Conspiracy deals with harder drugs and at larger scale, even though the Cornbread scale is superlative. You know, the federal government calls it the biggest domestic marijuana syndicate in American history. When they unravel it in 89, with Bluegrass Conspiracy, we're talking about allegations of plane loads of cocaine.
Right, right.
And so from the point of view of the Bluegrass Conspiracy bunch, Cornbread guys were seen as assets, moving product.
Right.
Right. So some of that cocaine that came in on those planes into Lexington probably got handled by some Cornbread guys down the line.
Right.
The Cornbread guys started exclusively as marijuana, and then into the 80s, some of those guys diversified their holdings into cocaine. Some of them did not.
Right.
The ones who did not get involved in cocaine were the ones who were more likely to not get caught. But still, cocaine definitely entered that ecosystem, and it entered it, maybe not exclusively through the Bluegrass Conspiracy connection, but those guys would eventually socialize together. It's like some of those Lexington parties that got really crazy. The Anita Madden scene. There was definitely some mixing of all those groups of people and places like that.
So let's kind of dive into this a little bit. 1987, a guy named Johnny Boone, you knew him. Right. And you actually, because of your relationship with him, you were subpoenaed under the Obama administration as they were trying to figure out this dragnet. Tell me about that.
So it took me a year of working on the book to get Johnny Boone to talk to me. I was in touch with him for about a year, working with him to help me better understand the situation. He was very careful and cautious about what he talked to me about. Wouldn't talk to me about anyone else,
right,
and would only talk to me about what I brought to him. He didn't give me new information. He helped me with what I was discovering on my own.
And he was a fugitive that was caught in Canada eventually, right? I mean, at the time your book was released, he was on the run.
Correct. So to be clear, I was talking to him when he was merely an ex-convict before he went on the run.
Okay.
I had a book contract with a major publishing house that in March of 2008, so this is how far back in time we're going, but in March of 2008, the original book contract that I was working on was canceled. And because that contract was canceled, I moved back to New York to try to hustle another book contract, but it was 2008. And that's when Amazon took control of the publishing industry and the economy tanked and Lehman Brothers collapsed, et cetera, et cetera.
Okay.
So I moved back to New York in March of 08, and then 2 months later in May, Johnny gets caught and goes on the run.
Okay. So, but you were talking to him in between that period of time.
Correct.
And so how did he play into all of this? Is he the ringleader?
Well, it's difficult to call him the ringleader. He definitely ran a crew.
Okay.
But the way the Cornbread operation worked is it was not rigidly hierarchical like you imagine Italian organized crime to
right.
be organized.
It was more like a bunch of good old boys that were kind of doing their thing cooperatively.
Yeah, it was like a marketplace. Like sometimes they were cooperative and other times they were competitive, depending on the circumstances and the situation.
Right. Right.
And each of these, they were all kind of different cells acting independently of each other. Mm-hmm. And most of these cells were family based, so like groups of brothers or, cousins, or uncles, nephews, like, family units working together. And then, they were either competing against each other or maybe they were helping each other fill an order.
How did all of these different, I mean, do you have an estimate of how many cells there were and how did they all operate out of such a small town as Lebanon and Marion County?
I wouldn't have an idea of how many cells. I mean, I know between 85 and 89, there were 70 guys arrested on 30 farms in 10 states with 200 tons of marijuana.
Wow, that's insane. That is a lot of marijuana.
But of those 70 that were arrested, none of them talk.
Right.
So how many were not arrested because 70 people kept their mouth shut?
Right.
Is a question that's impossible.
So there's
to
gotta
answer.
Be people running around now that were part of this that their names just never got mentioned and
100%.
They've just moved Absolutely. On to other things, or perhaps they're still doing what they were doing, maybe just not in the same organized way.
Exactly right.
Kind of walk me through what a meeting with a guy like Johnny Boone was like. I mean, he seems like the portrayal of him is he's just kind of this laid back guy that, just sort of, he's just selling marijuana. I mean, he doesn't seem like a bad dude. Some people will say you are because you were selling illicit drugs, but how we feel about marijuana aside, it didn't seem like a bad dude.
I mean, he's clearly a brilliant country boy. He's
right.
a farmer, but brilliant, like one of the most naturally intelligent people I've ever met.
Right.
But that's not to say that he doesn't understand how to carry himself in dangerous situations. The federal government sent him to Terre Haute, the maximum security
right.
prison that was informally a gladiator school. If he didn't know how to take care of himself before then, he certainly did then.
Right.
So the federal government, by imposing state sanctioned violence against marijuana cultivators, didn't turn him into anything, but
hardened.
Enacted state, hardened, enacted state sanctioned violence upon him
right.
for a period of time that was, not, should not have been in accordance to, what he was convicted of doing.
Right. So was this before or after all of this?
He got busted from that bust in 87 that we're talking
okay,
about.
Okay, all right. And then he was out, and that's when you talked to him between then and then when the federal government went after him much more aggressively.
Again.
Yeah, okay.
Correct.
So walk me through how the Cornbread Mafia operated from, say, its beginnings where it's being cultivated to the consumer on the street.
Well, it starts when some of these guys from Marion County get drafted into the Vietnam War. They go off to Vietnam and they see robust cannabis marijuana use.
This is Copperhead Road. It's the whole song. It's Copperhead Road.
It's Copperhead Road. I mean, it's very much the same thing. So these country boys go off to Vietnam, see the value of marijuana in Vietnam and what people in the cities are willing to pay for it. They're still hemp growing wild behind their grandfather's barns from the World War II hemp for victory effort.
Right.
So all they know is that they can grow it and get paid. All they have to do is not get caught. but not getting caught in connection with the alcohol and moonshining legacy culture that existed in Marion County was the easiest thing in the world.
Right.
So they just realized, you know, there, here was this new thing that they could do, and farming wasn't any big deal. I mean, all these guys grew up stripping tobacco as, you know, as boys and, you know, teenagers. So, you know, growing it by the acre was no big deal. So they just went out and grew it by the acre.
How did they hide it? Or is it just that nobody cared? It's that the law enforcement looked the other way locally. So it was this, this permissive atmosphere that you mentioned that allowed this to sort of fester.
So, well, I don't know if fester is the right word, but for 10 years from like 1970 to 1980, these guys grew it by the acre in Marion County, hidden from the road, but not really from anywhere else.
Right.
When guys got arrested or caught doing it, it was a $500 fine and a 6-month suspended sentence. They'd go down to the courthouse and pay it in cash and go home.
Right. Okay. And then start growing again.
You know, just not the same place that they got caught doing it. The first time the Kentucky State Police flew a helicopter for a marijuana eradication mission was over Marion County in the fall of 1980, and in one weekend they found 45 acres of marijuana.
How did Marion County at the time stack up against Eastern Kentucky for illicit drug operations, alcohol operations, etc.?
Well, I don't want to get into a contest with the 606 area code. However, I'm pretty confident that operating at this scale began in Marion County.
Okay.
The illicit marijuana cultivation that goes on in Eastern Kentucky, primarily in the Daniel Boone National Forest,
right,
is a result of Reagan-era drug laws and property seizure and asset forfeiture,
right,
that didn't go into effect until the late 80s. Before then, a farmer could grow on their farm, and if they got caught, they still had their farm.
Right. Now this is why, you know, I've seen a lot of these documentaries and listened to a lot of podcasts about, you know, marijuana grows in national parks and on, you know, federal land. This is kind of the result of the seizing of land where people are like, well, screw it, I won't risk my property, I'll just go grow on federal land.
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. It's a response to the drug fighting policy. If the federal government, if the state government wasn't threatening to seize property, then no one would go on federal land to grow it.
They'd still be growing it on their own.
Correct.
And getting caught and paying fines. Was the Cornbread Mafia violent at all?
I mean, you know, when you're operating outside the law, there's no access to courts to adjudicate business disagreements. So violence is inherent in the nature of outlaw business, even if it's relatively nonviolent, there's still violence.
Right. So these guys that were in competition with each other, when they crossed each other in some way, form, or fashion, how was that adjudicated out? Was there some sort of leadership faction that would assess the wrongdoing and then hand down the punishment, or did they just war with each other until they worked it out, a la Hatfield-McCoy style? Oh, are you there?
Sorry, yes, I'm here. Okay. I fat-cheeked the mute button.
Oh, okay, I was like, what happened?
So there's no Hatfield and McCoy style intergenerational gunfight.
Right.
So they avoid that. There are, you know, casualties. There are dead bodies along the way. There are people who ended up no longer with us.
Right.
And you know, the problem is finding the dividing line, like where that starts and stops.
Right.
The Cornbread Mafia, just in sort of general terms, is often associated with these unsolved murders in Bardstown.
Right.
And
I was going to ask that, is there any connection there? Any Lexus there? What? Or Nexus?
No, I mean, other than they're happening in the same geographical area, I don't, like, it's definitely not like what is associated with the Cornbread Mafia as, you know, as cannabis cultivators in that region. Like,
right,
these killings don't follow that MO.
Right. Yeah, there's something. I listened to a podcast about those killings, and specifically the Officer Ellis one. It seemed very. It was very specific set of skills, it seemed, that went into action on that, which, at least from what I've read about reports, doesn't flow with the MO of how this organization worked.
Yeah, I mean, generally speaking, the Cornbread guys treated police officers like a cat and mouse game.
Right.
I mean, before the federal sentences got really severe in the
it was Dukes of Hazzard.
Yeah, it was kind of Dukes of Hazzard. It was touch, like, you know, it was catch me if you can kind of stuff.
Right.
And they kind of begrudgingly respected each other. Like, right. Here's this thing that's like it's time to go.
Right.
And there was some chasing, give and take involved. But as the federal government ramps up its penalties and increases the stakes, then it also increases the danger towards law enforcement for people trying to avoid those consequences.
Well, I also think it increases the level of dangerous individuals that get involved in the game. You know, now we're dealing probably, and I don't have any inside knowledge of this, but it just appears to me, as someone who grew up on the border with Mexico, it appears to me that we're dealing now almost exclusively in the drug realm with cartels.
I don't know about exclusively, but it certainly seems the case. And the Courier Journal on Thanksgiving had that.
Yeah, I saw that
amazing investigative piece on the reach of a cartel that I'd never heard of before until the Courier Journal blasted it out on Thanksgiving. And I haven't seen any follow-ups on that, but you know, I do think that cartel violence has its fingers in small town Kentucky. That's a real thing.
Right.
And our prohibition against marijuana and other drugs done to make us feel safe has in fact made us less safe.
So the Cornbread Mafia, are they still in operation, or is it just gone by the wayside? And like we said, there's probably people that were involved in it running their own thing now, but is it less organized, or does it still exist? Is it still a thing?
I mean, there's always going to be some boutique outlaw cannabis getting grown,
right?
And there's some guys out there who are very good at it and who have cultivated strains that are well suited for the environment. But operating on the scale that they were operating in the 70s and 80s, like, that's just not possible now because of DEA grants to Kentucky State Police and you know, constant helicopter surveillance and Supreme Court decisions along the way that make personal property rights difficult to protect.
Right. Yeah. And I want to get into that in just a second here. But before we do, during your writing of this book, during your interviews, during your investigations, did you ever feel for a concern for your own safety?
Oh yeah. I mean, there's a couple of good times where I got, you know, some real good death threats. I mean, like, nothing makes you feel more alive than a really good death threat.
That's fascinating. I'm sorry. I shouldn't make light of it. It's the way you put that. It's kind of funny.
I mean, well, it's just the truth. Like, just like, it's like, yeah. Woo,
yeah.
You know, like, you know, I'm going to kill you.
Right. Right.
You know, it's like, oh, that's, and you know, into varying degrees of seriousness, some of it is misunderstanding that I can communicate. Others are more serious than misunderstanding. Some people just don't like what I've done.
Right.
Some of that concern existed before I wrote the book, and then once the book was out, there was no point in threatening me anymore because it was already done.
Right. Right.
So, you know, it's, you know, but along the way, the people and organization that made me feel the most threatened wasn't any outlaw organization. It was the U.S. Marshal Service.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you were subpoenaed by the Obama administration.
Well, I was subpoenaed by the U.S. Marshal Service and happened to be signed off on by the Obama Justice Department, sort of in the transition after Bush left office.
Right.
I had taken these photographs of Johnny Boone in a location that was clearly not Kentucky. One of those photographs is the cover of the book.
Yeah, I see. I saw that. Yeah. It's like, looks fairly tropical.
I made one set of prints of those photographs. I gave them to Johnny Boone And then when he got in trouble and went on the run, those photographs were in his residence, and federal agents seized them, knew that I had taken them, and wanted me to tell them where I had taken them.
Right. But you're and a journalist. You shouldn't have to reveal that because he's your source.
That was my position.
Of course,
that was my
of course, it's obvious that he was your source now. But I mean, at the time, were you being public about the fact that you were working with him?
Well, with the U.S. Marshal Service, I certainly was.
Right.
Where this got crossways is that the U.S. Marshal Service had seized these photographs, and then they were using those photographs as part of their media release of Johnny Boone.
Okay.
So when TV stations were saying, "Have you seen this man?" they were using my photographs.
Right.
And it made it look like I had given them to law enforcement to use, which was not the case.
Right. So
and that misunderstanding could have been, you know, like, I didn't want anyone misunderstanding that point.
Right. Right.
So I reached out to the Marshal Service directly, and I was like, "Hey, you know who I am. Can you stop using those pictures, please? You have other pictures of this guy. You don't need mine."
Right.
And then they responded with subpoenaing me.
So how did you navigate through that?
I hired a really good attorney who was a guy from Lebanon, whose name is Jack Smith. He's a former U.S. attorney and knew everybody at the federal courthouse. And we filed a motion to quash the subpoena on my First Amendment rights as a journalist. That motion was denied. But it red flagged the prosecutor because, oh no, is this guy claiming to be a journalist? Do we as the Justice Department have to follow this 5-page long guideline for subpoenaing a member of the news media?
Right.
Does this guy qualify as a member of the news media? I wasn't working for a news organization. I had a book contract. I was a freelancer. I'd made a certain amount of money the year before as a freelancer. And so that day I was due to appear in the grand jury at 1 or 1:30, like right after lunch. And they released me and put me back on the next plane to New York.
Wow. Fascinating. Did Boone get mad at you?
Say that again.
Did Johnny Boone get mad at you? Did he think that you had given them those photographs?
On that point, no. I mean, I effectively navigated that situation so that there was no miscommunication.
Right.
It's clear that I did not give them that photograph and that I risked 18 months in prison to not talk about where I had taken those photographs.
Right. I mean, again, we're talking basic First Amendment stuff here. I mean, this is
basic First Amendment stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, you're trying to get a story out. The good that comes from the story, just the public knowledge of things that were going on in a set community, you know, outweighs, I would think, the need to figure out where exactly those pictures were taken, you know, in the end. And not to make this political, but I assume that you and I probably feel the same way about marijuana anyway, that the whole thing is silly that we spend so much law enforcement resources trying to take out what is a natural herb, which we could probably regulate, tax, and feel a lot better about, and a lot of these farmers could make a lot more money doing something that's regulated and taxed in a way that we understand that it's the healthiest version of it. But instead, we get the illicit version, and we get organizations like this that crop up inevitably. I don't know. How do you feel about the way that politics is taking a turn on marijuana these days?
Well, it's you know, silly is not the word I would use. I would use tragic.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's, you know, when we get past this sort of tumultuous transition period that we're currently in, we will look back at the war on drugs as a shameful legacy of America's racist past, and that we were using the war on drugs to criminalize black men and to disenfranchise them from voting.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
And guys like these cornbread mafia guys just got caught up along the way.
Yeah. No. And it's interesting how, too, like, you look at the reaction currently of, you know, people are freaking out about the opioid addiction. They didn't really care that much about the crack addiction, you know, and there's questions about whether our government might have been even involved in some of that. So I think you make an interesting point. And it's not that I want people doing drugs. I'm not for legalization across the board, but I am for a lot less criminalization of it. And I am for maybe putting that money that we use to incarcerate people into rehab. And as far as marijuana goes, it's just it's a plant, you know. I mean, it's a plant, you know. So
the criminal justice impact of this is just diabolical. Like,
right.
What it does to communities, particularly Black communities, it just really when you internalize the effects that the drug war have had on Black communities, it's difficult to look away.
In
the West End of Louisville, for instance, the registered voter pool is like 65% Black women.
Mm-hmm.
And that's because so many Black men have been pinned with felonies and disenfranchised and
right.
unable to vote because they get tagged with a drug crime, and then they plead out to a low class felony to stay out of prison.
Right.
But it's like a tag and release. Like, they get released, but then they have a felony on their record and they can't vote.
Right.
Can't get a job, and they spiral back into the system.
It's a self perpetuating cycle. Try, you know, I mean, you can find a job if you've got a felony on your record, but it's awfully difficult. And certainly you're not going to be worth as much money long term. And that's why it becomes more attractive to get back into the criminal cycle. As far as the violent criminals, I have no sympathy for them. But when we're talking about nonviolent drug crimes and people that are having their lives ruined over it, it seems like there would be a lot better way for society to deal with that. One of the things that's interesting in all of this, and you know, me, as long as I've been involved in radio and media, you know, I've kind of been pounding this drum, and one of the things about it is like the whole hemp side of it, the misinformation about hemp. And now we finally got to where Kentucky is, I think, emerging as a leader in hemp, and you yourself have actually started a hemp company. Tell me a little bit about that.
Right. So Cornbread Hemp is the sort of logical outgrowth of my work in this space, having become the historian and reporter who cracked the case on the Cornbread Mafia. You know, before I wrote that book, no one had talked about it. It was virtually forgotten. And I sort of, you know, brought it back out of the ashes. The success of the book led me into a journalism career where I was covering cannabis news for major publications at a national level. And then in 2018, covering the farm bill that was going to legalize hemp, I was covering it for Politico in D.C., but out in Western Kentucky on a story for it, and realized then what the opportunity was. And my first cousin is my business partner. He has an MBA and an e-commerce background. His name is Eric Zipperly, and we got together in late 2018, got a seed investor, and went to work on this company. And now Cornbread Hemp is the first Kentucky company to offer USDA certified organic CBD products, which is really important for us. And we think will be a trend that drives the 2020 cycle for CBD. There's thousands of CBD brands in
right.
the market now.
Right.
And with a varying range of credibility and quality of product, some of these products are really bad. And there's, because the FDA is not coming in with regulations, things are getting worse.
Right.
But the one thing that we do have is the high standards offered by the USDA organics program. And by meeting those high standards, which are sort of above and beyond what the general standards for CBD ought to be, but because the FDA hasn't weighed in, USDA organic is the only stamp of approval the federal government will give a CBD product.
Right.
So we went out of our way last year to make sure that we rang that bell. And turns out we were the first ones and still the only.
I'm a big fan of CBD oil when it's a good product. I've been giving it to my dogs. I have dogs, three rescue dogs. The two of them are approaching 16 years old now.
Mm-hmm.
And I started giving them hemp about a month ago, and it's unbelievable the difference in their digestion, their calmness, mm-hmm. as well as their energy levels and their lack of pain in movement. So I started taking it myself as a sleep aid, and I got to tell you, I started taking it about 2 weeks ago, and you know, I use a good product. You're right about that. You have to be very careful to vet, you know, the organizations that you buy it from, not because they're bad or anything, but just a lot of people out there offering a product. And so I've got an mm-hmm. organic product, and I'm telling you, for the last 2 weeks, I've got the best sleep I've ever had in my life. It's ridiculous. It's not, it doesn't make you drowsy. It's just I take it right before I go to bed, and I go into this deep, really rejuvenating, incredibly comfortable sleep, and it lasts all night long. It's unbelievable. And I highly, you know, basically want to tell people I highly recommend the use of CBD. It's a natural thing. There's no THC or highness. You don't get high. It's not marijuana. But gosh, the health benefits are phenomenal. So
we like to say it doesn't get you high. It gets you middle.
For some people, it might just get you back to life. You know what I mean?
Well, but what we mean by getting you middle is that CBD, again, because the FDA has not come in on regulations, it's difficult for us to make what they would call medical claims. It's
right.
difficult for us
sure.
to express our First Amendment rights to tell people what this product has shown to do. But without making medical claims, studies show that CBD bonds with our internal endocannabinoid system.
Right.
And what the endocannabinoid system is interested in doing is bringing the other systems of the body back into balance.
Right.
And so that's why CBD seems to work for so many different types of issues, is because the endocannabinoid system is always trying to bring systems back into balance, whether right. that's the digestive system or in your case you're the sleep that you're experiencing. So it's not a traditional sedative. It doesn't knock you out.
Nope.
What it does is it balances your wake sleep cycle.
Right.
It helps you be asleep when you're at night. It helps you be awake during the day.
It really does. And what I've noticed from it is you feel a lot better in the daytime. And I've studied nutrition quite a bit because I had a health incident a few years ago that scared me. And I went to look for answers, and I found those answers in changing my nutrition. And it's been an unbelievable ride. And the one component I didn't have was really good sleep. And, you know, CBD oil made 8 hours of sleep absolutely not only possible but easy for me, and it's fantastic. So it's kind of like that one last component. So I highly recommend it. Is there a website that people can go and check out your product?
Oh yeah, thank you for asking. It's cornbreadhemp.com, and we're at cornbreadhemp on Twitter and Instagram, and certainly on Facebook. We're also on cornbreadhemp on Facebook. You know, just recommend folks reaching out and touch a base. If folks are in the Louisville area, we serve a number of retailers, but principally the Rainbow Blossom locations. There's 5 Rainbow Blossoms in the Louisville area. But we're also in Cox's Smokers Outlet. We're in, you know, Up in Smoke Outlet. We're in, you know, we're in the One Love Hemp Dispensary. We're at 502 Hemp. We're in, you know, everywhere that CBD is sold, where it's more than just one product on the shelf.
Right.
Some of these CBD stores are just one product. We don't, you know, obviously don't deal with those folks. But if people are used to buying their CBD in a certain place and Cornbread Hemp is not on the shelf, talk to your retailer about talking to us.
Awesome. Before I close this out, give me, and I want people to get your book and read it, The Cornbread Mafia by James Higdon. Give me one exciting story, though, from the book, a teaser, if you will, for people who might want to go buy it.
Gosh. I just spent the night at the Campbell House Inn in Lexington last week.
That's storied history right there.
And I was with somebody, and they were asking me about Campbell House. I was like, yeah, this place has been here forever. There's a scene in my book from it. And they were like, what? I'm like, yeah. There was a deal here that went bad, and someone got put in a trunk and drove out of here. And they were asking me what happened to the guy. I'm like, no, the guy in the trunk was fine, but I think that he might have killed the guy who put him in the trunk, and that guy disappeared forever. It was one of those kinds of stories. You were asking about violence earlier. That's sort of a, you know, one of the juicier violent tidbits.
So the moral of the story is never put the wrong guy in a trunk.
I mean, you know, I hate to, you know, I hate to find a moral to this story.
Right. I don't think there is one.
There are no winners in this particular story, but right. I think the moral is, if you're going to put someone in the trunk of a car, which is never an if-then statement that you want to be a part of.
Right.
But if you're going to put someone in the trunk, you should frisk them first to make sure they're not carrying a firearm.
That's a great point.
Because when that trunk opens up, they might come out firing.
Yeah, that's a very good point. Hey, listen, it's fascinating talking to you. The book is The Cornbread Mafia, a homegrown syndicate's code of silence and the biggest marijuana bust in American history. I'm glad there's journalists out there doing what you do and standing up for the First Amendment. These stories are part of our history. They're part of our culture. I'm not making light of anything that happened with this, but they're still important stories to tell and pass on. And it's important that we maintain that right for journalists to be able to dig into this and earn the trust of people to get these stories out, because they have lessons in life for everybody. So I appreciate what you do, and I thank you for taking the time to chat with us today on the Disruption Zone.
Thanks, Leland. I appreciate it.
Fascinating stuff, I tell you. All right, lots to come on the Disruption Zone. Let's see, who do we have? Oh, we don't forget we have this series going on with Congressman Thomas Massie. The next one's going to be about farm freedom. It's Thomas Massie and the D.C. Swamp Monster, and we're going to have episode 3 of that 6-to-8-part series coming up here in the next couple of weeks, so stay tuned for that. You can follow us on Instagram, it's at GreatLelando, or on the Twitter, it's at Leland Show, and of course, at Zone Disruption, and at The Disruption Zone on Instagram, so follow us there. The best way you can help is to share this podcast, share it with your friends, and have them subscribe. It is free on Apple Podcasts and Google Play and wherever podcasts are found. Thanks to my co-host and co-sponsor, Cameron Mills, and to our production partners, DXAudio.com, Dynamics Audio Productions in Lexington, Kentucky, for all your production needs. And again, thanks for listening. I'm Leland Conway on The Disruption Zone.